From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Cheers, Ollie. Thanks a lot. Coming up for 3 minutes past the hour. Tuesday, the 26th of March, 2019. Your Richie Allen Show. Kevin Barrett joins the programme, live from Wisconsin, in the second hour. But before that, got a very important news roundup for you. Some really interesting things going on. A variety of stuff to talk about. Tweet me, it's at Richie Allen Show. As usual, I'll be delighted to hear from you.
Welcome back to the most listened to independent radio show in Europe. It's your Richie Allen Show. It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Right, as usual, there's lots to talk about. We're live on Fab Radio 2 here in Manchester, triggerwarning.tv, TuneIn Radio, and my own website, richieallen.co.uk. As I said, Kevin Barrett in the second hour will talk about Israel, Gaza, Palestine. We'll also talk about war crimes in Yemen. Very interesting developments there today. Going to get into that in the monologue as well. Loads to get into, and we're going to jump straight in because I'm thinking I might struggle with the hour. There's so much to talk about today. Hope you've had a good Tuesday. As always, you're in fine fettle wherever you happen to be in the world. And thanks, as always, for joining me live. I really do appreciate that. Lovely one again in Manchester today. Gorgeous weather. Really lovely weather today. Brexit roundup. Won't spend too much time on it. Don't get excited. Don't yawn. Don't groan. Well, yawn if you want, but don't groan anyway, because it's important stuff. I'll be as brief as I can with it, because I want to get on to vaccines then, and social media. Little bit of the copyright directive of the European Union as well. So, like I said, lots to get into. Now, last night, the government lost control of the Brexit process. Right? What happened was MPs voted in favour of taking control of the process from the government. And this was made possible after 30 Conservative MPs, including three ministers, voted against their own government. This was the Oliver Letwin Amendment. Now, tomorrow, Wednesday, there will be a series of indicative votes in Westminster to decide the way forward, or in other words, to find a majority in the House of Commons for a way to proceed. Now, there is no date as of yet for Theresa May's withdrawal deal to go before the House for the third time. You might remember, twice it's been defeated. She was due to bring it back again. It was suggested today it might happen. It was suggested tomorrow. Now they're saying Friday. Nobody knows what's going on. But MPs have control of the order of business at Westminster, which is unprecedented, really. All sorts of things are happening that have never happened before, right? Statutory procedure, laws, rules and regulations being ignored, the rule book being torn up. Or you could say it in three words, Brexit is fucked. It's gone. But we knew that anyway, didn't we? Brexiteer and European Research Group member Jacob Rees-Mogg has indicated that he will vote for Theresa May's deal if and when it comes back this week. Now, this is something he had previously described as worse than staying in, and we'll come back to that in a minute. So, with news of Jacob Rees-Mogg and some perspective, let's hear from Sky News reporter Kate McCann, was at Westminster this afternoon.
That's a very, very good question, Kay. Well, Jacob Rees-Mogg has today come out and said that now, after all this time, all this opposition to the Prime Minister's deal, he's decided actually the best thing to do is probably to support it. Now, that has something to do with what's going on in Parliament just behind me, but it also has a lot to do with the Prime Minister yesterday pretty definitively saying that no deal is never going to happen unless Parliament votes for it. And the one thing that we do know that Parliament is united against is no deal. But as for what's happening over in the Commons, we now have the process for those so-called indicative votes. So we're a bit clearer about how tomorrow is going to work. Remember, MPs have effectively taken control of the order paper and given themselves the power to dictate what happens in the House of Commons. This is incredibly rare. It never happens, and it is a pretty big deal for the Prime Minister. So tomorrow, they will all suggest different views of Brexit, different ways that Brexit could proceed. This could be things like revoking Article 50. That's the amendment that the SNP are going to table. They suggest that revoke ought to be the backstop instead of no deal. And there are others too, a customs union, Norway deal, all kinds of different options. And the Speaker will then select the ones that he thinks there could be a majority for, and MPs will be allowed to vote on them. But interestingly, in this process, it also sets out that MPs will again take over the order paper on Monday. So they will get another chance to go through these options again next week. Now, why does that matter? Well, the Prime Minister was told by the European Council that she must bring her deal back for a vote this week. That means she has to get all the MPs in the Commons, or as many as she possibly can, to back her plans in order for the UK to leave the European Union in the way that she wants, and to get that extension for her to get the legislation through Parliament. Now, the issue she's going to have is that lots of MPs here are biding their time. They're waiting to see what happens with that indicative vote process, and what is one thing is for certain is there is not much time left for that to happen.
No, there's not much time left at all. Now, Jacob Rees-Mogg has indicated he will vote for Theresa May's deal. I don't think it matters, because it won't pass anyway, because the Democratic Unionist Party, which is propping up the Conservative government, the DUPs have indicated they won't vote for it under any circumstances. Obviously, Labour won't, the SNPs won't, and the handful of Lib Dems and the one Green Party MP won't either. But some staunch or hardline Brexiteers see this move by Jacob Rees-Mogg as an unforgivable betrayal, because Mogg was probably the most vocal critic of Theresa May's deal in terms of explaining why May's agreement, withdrawal agreement with the EU, is in fact worse than staying in. Remember the things that Jacob Rees-Mogg was saying about May's deal?
The problem with the withdrawal agreement is that it doesn't do what the Conservative Party said we would do. In our manifesto, said we would leave the customs union, but Annex 2 under the backstop would keep us in the customs union. We have had endless guarantees that the United Kingdom would not be divided. But the whole appendix divides Northern Ireland from the rest of Great Britain, something that unionists are opposed to in principle, not just as the details of a treaty, but because it seeks to divide our country. The Conservatives and those who campaigned for Brexit always said that we must be free from the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice. Why? Why? Because the court is a political court as well as a legal court. And because, Mr. Speaker, something that I know you think is very important, it could overrule this House and overrule our democracy and make laws for us that could not be stopped by Parliament. Unless, of course, we withdrew altogether, which is what we are doing with the purpose of taking away its authority to rule over us. And for this, for the potential of being locked in a customs union, for dividing our nation up, and for allowing the European Court of Justice to continue, we are going to pay our European friends £39 billion of taxpayers' money. For that, we get nothing in return, no guarantee of any trade deal in future, but a vacuous political statement that could mean anything to anybody.
Yes, May's deal means staying in the European Union. It's Brexit in name only, but it's worse. Right, the freedom of movement continues. The European Union having access, or EU countries having access to UK waters continues. I could be here all day long. It's horrendous. That was Mogg then. Now Mogg is saying that he will more than likely vote with Theresa May when it comes back. Oh dear, Jacob. Why? I could tell you why, but I'd be wasting your time and my time. You know yourself, without me giving you a long-winded rant about politicians and what they really are. One of the Tories who defied Theresa May last night and voted for MPs to take control of the process is former business minister Richard Harrington. He spoke with Sky News' Adam Bolton this AM. Listen up.
Well, I don't think people who were unfortunately influenced by one of the most dishonest campaigns in democratic history, this nonsense about 80 million Turkish people coming over here, the rubbish about all this money that would go to the NHS, people voted for a number of reasons, but I'm sure very few people voted for what they would know would be a short-term economic disaster.
Interesting that Harrington makes the claim that the Vote Leave side told a pack of lies exclusively, that Remainers didn't lie at all. I'm very honest about it. As a reporter, as a presenter, they all told lies, there's no doubt about it. Anyway, what else does he say?
We're running out of patience with the Brexiteers now. I think many of us have tried our best to compromise on both sides of the argument, but it will reach the stage soon where the frustration, as shown by a million people marching to London and all these people who've gone on the petition to vote for revoke, it reaches the stage where they're going to have to be listened to as well.
Would you, if you get the opportunity in the meaningful vote or to sign the petition, would you back revoke?
If there's no alternative, I will support anything other than no deal. I'll look at any reasonable alternative. But if the alternative was, shall we say, no deal or no Brexit, I'd choose no Brexit any time.
See, what's going to happen now tomorrow and possibly into Thursday, now that members of Parliament have taken control of the process and they are overwhelmingly, as a group, MPs in favour of remaining, there are going to be indicative votes tomorrow and, as I said, possibly into Thursday. And those votes will include asking MPs if they want to revoke Article 50, which effectively means just stopping the leaving process, just putting a halt to the process of leaving. That's going to be one on there. They're also going to vote on holding a second referendum. So you can see how it's all collapsing now in the manner, in the exact way to the letter that I predicted it would happen. This is what's happening, right? Anything else from this goon, Richard Harrington?
Now, why is that? Could you just tell us, you've been a business minister, what you believe the impact would be if in, 17 days' time?
Yeah, forget it. He's just going to give a whole load of hyperbole and unsubstantiated nonsense about how business would collapse if the UK left with no deals. We don't need to listen to that. But later on, the hotelier and the head of the eponymous group, Rocco Forte, was on Ian King Live. He's an interesting guy, businessman, fairly disgusted, and he reminds the Sky News audience of what we face if we leave on May's withdrawal agreement, which isn't likely, let's be honest about it, but it compounds the lunacy of Jacob Rees-Mogg deciding now to support it. Here's Rocco Forte explaining how bad things would be leaving on Theresa May's terms, which is the Brexit in name only. Rocco Forte.
We end up with all the disadvantages of staying in the European Union without any of the advantages. We will have no say in legislation that's passed which will affect this country and also our trade policy. So we will not be able to lower tariffs to suit our industries and our economy. And we'll be stuck under control of the European Union.
I was just saying, Jacob Rees-Mogg there appears to, one of the leading Brexit voices, appears to have swung behind Theresa May's deal. Would you now encourage others to do this?
I think we're in a very humiliating position. We've been made to look a laughingstock across the world. And I think to some degree we've abandoned democracy and we seem to have dictatorship run by the elite in this country. But I think we have to face the reality and be pragmatic. And I would support the Mrs. May's withdrawal agreement on the basis that she would stand down and that the whole negotiating team is changed. We have a Brexiteer in charge and some hard-nosed people who know how to negotiate, who are not engaged in a diplomatic exercise with the European Union, to run the show. I think then we'd have a chance of pulling some irons out of the fire.
All right, so who would you like to see succeed Theresa May then?
Well, I think there are a number of candidates. At the end of the day, it's not for me to say which one is...
Yeah, he goes on to mention Boris Johnson and Dominic Raab, the former Brexit secretary. It's interesting there. He's outlined why May's withdrawal agreement is horrendous, But then he said he'd vote for it so long as May resigned. And then you got a Brexit-supporting Prime Minister and Brexit Secretary. It's been widely rumoured today that senior backbenchers, the ERG, that's Jacob Rees-Mogg and others, have told May that their condition for supporting her deal is that she resigns effectively tomorrow. So it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that May will be gone tomorrow. I'm not saying it will happen, but that's what's been widely rumoured today, that Brexiteers and those who haven't supported May from a Conservative backbench point of view have said to her, we'll vote for this as long as you guarantee that you leave this week, possibly tomorrow. Shall we leave Brexit, shall we? Shall we just forget all about Brexit just for today? What do you think? Yeah, because you think you're sick of it. I'm sick of it. I've known this for 2.5 years, what's going to happen. But for future generations, I mean, these programmes, not just this programme, but others, they'll be online forever, hopefully. And they'll be there for posterity. So people can look back and go, yeah, this is what happened. Because when they go to the BBC, Channel 4, Sky News, Fox News archives, they won't get the truth. But anyway, let's leave let's leave Brexit there. The time coming up for 19 minutes past the hour. It is your Richie Allen Show. It is live. It's live right now anyway. Saudi Arabia has killed over 100,000 people in Yemen by now in 4 years. At least. Why? Why do you come to that conclusion and that figure, you might ask? Well, the United Nations is saying that it's tens of thousands. Well, you can probably times that by three if they're saying tens of thousands. 4 years of bombardment. And you might have read yesterday that a letter was sent to the government by Britain's five main opposition parties demanding that the UK government stop selling arms to the lunatic asylum that is Saudi Arabia, the head-chopping capital of the world. Riyadh, Looney Tunes, nutcases. So the five opposition parties have said, stop giving these wackos weapons because they are murdering hundreds of thousands, well, 100,000 at least, and maiming and ruining the lives of hundreds of thousands more. The letter was given to Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt, right, by the five parties. Jeremy Corbyn has been speaking about this, not, I wouldn't have said in any very strong or very determined fashion, but he's mentioned it. He signed a letter anyway, which says that after 4 years of intolerable suffering and degradation, time is running out. Yemen stands on the brink of catastrophe. The UK government must condemn the reckless and barbaric behaviour of the Saudi government, suspend the sale of arms to the regime, and launch a comprehensive and independent investigation of all alleged war crimes. There was an urgent question put forward by the Labour Party today in Westminster, and Gavin Williamson, the Defence Secretary, didn't even show up to take this question, showing what a contemptuous little shit he is. He sent a lackey instead, a guy called Mark Field. So there was an urgent question about war crimes being committed in Yemen, using British weaponry and overseen by British Army officers who are in Riyadh, who are in control rooms and overseeing the slaughter. This is true. So Emily Thornberry is the Shadow Foreign Secretary, and she asked Mark Field, Minister of State, Mark, have British soldiers witnessed war crimes in Yemen? This is important. You'll hear Emily Thornberry, then you'll hear the answer.
There is one especially disturbing allegation in the Mail on Sunday's report, which was that our forces are providing support to locally recruited Saudi-funded militia, where many of the fighters, up to 40% it was alleged, are children as young as 13 years old. So I would ask the Minister of State if that is in any way true. Because if it is, then it would confirm that our forces are not just a party to this conflict, but witnesses to war crimes.
She will appreciate, and I think she did expressly appreciate that obviously in relation to special forces, we do not comment or either confirm or deny any involvement. Clearly, she is well aware that we have liaison officers who are based in Saudi Arabia and have been routinely. I'm very keen, if I may, not to in any way inadvertently mislead the House on this matter, and therefore I will, she will forgive me, ensure that she has a written response liaising with the Ministry of Defence about the issue, about other engagement or involvement of British personnel in Yemen.
All right, move on. Nothing to see here. Please disperse. Nothing to see.
Nothing to see here. I did Gavin Williamson a disservice, by the way. I owe the man an apology. Jeremy Hunt should have been there, the Foreign Secretary, not the Defence Secretary. Jeremy Hunt wasn't there. He's the weasel who sent his lackey to do his bidding. Nothing to see here. I can't talk about this. I can't talk about that. We'll get a letter to you liaising with the MOD and we'll say no more about it. Here's another question on the war crimes in Yemen. This time from MP Emma Lewell Buck. She's an MP for South Shields. She's a Labour MP.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. The government clearly recognises the scale of the humanitarian crisis in Yemen because they've recently increased...
It's not Sarah Milliken. It's actually Emma Lewell Buck, Labour MP.
...aid. Yet, sickeningly, unlike Germany, Norway, Denmark and Finland, UK arms sales to Saudi Arabia continue. Does the minister feel that these continued arms sales are helping to cease or intensify the relentless and indiscriminate murder of innocent children and civilians?
Wait till you hear his answer, this guy Mark Field. Wait till you hear this.
I can only really refer to the Honourable Lady for South Shields to what I've said earlier on in relation to arms sales. Many of these, of course, are long-standing contracts that have, with arms that are in the hands of some of the combatants in the Saudi-led coalition in this regard. But there's nothing else really that I can usefully add to that answer.
Answer I gave earlier, the lady, the honourable member. He couldn't give a fuck. He's going to have a steak dinner and a bottle of Merlot later on. He won't give it another thought because he's a psychopath, totally unmoved by what's going on. Imagine the humiliation. You see, you, dear listener, you're a normal person. You're not a psychopath. So if you were to learn that arms being sold by your country, that you are a government minister representing, same, right, that those weapons were being used to indiscriminately murder men, women and children, you'd be disgusted by it. You'd be sickened. It might drive you mad. Not these psychopaths. Couldn't give a shit. And his boss, Jeremy Hunt, couldn't be arsed to even turn up. Lovely. 26 minutes past the hour. It's Tuesday's programme, March 26th. Now, the European Parliament has backed the controversial copyright law that critics have claimed will change the nature of the net. You heard this on the news at the top of the hour. The new rules will see technology companies be held responsible for material posted by users without proper copyright permission. Be afraid, be very afraid. This is very serious, right? So on the one hand, you have musicians and creators saying, well, this is good news because we'll get compensated. But the truth is vastly different than that. The copyright directive even was backed by 348 MEPs with 278 against. Several revisions, weren't there? I spoke to Hayden Hewitt about this. He knows a lot about this, of course. LiveLeak.com founder, co-founder. There were several revisions of the legislation, but it's got to the final form and it has been voted on. Now, it's up to member states of the European Union to approve this decision. If and when they do, they will have 2 years to implement it. Okay. So the controversy was around clauses 11 and 13, or Article 11 and Article 13. Article 11 states that search engines and news aggregate platforms should pay to use links from news websites. This is incredible. Search engines and news aggregate platforms should pay to use links from news websites. Yes, they are talking about this programme as well. And Article 13 wants to hold technology companies responsible for material posted without a copyright licence. I mentioned that already. And as has been said on this programme before, there are a lot of good reasons for people who create content to upload work that has been copyrighted. Often for the purpose of critiquing, often for the purpose of dissenting or arguing or demonstrating something to be false. And I could go on. This is genuine tyranny, this. And I spoke last year about this. I can only speak about how it will affect this programme. If it goes through, if it is adopted, and if it's rubber stamped, I won't ever again be able to take a bit of audio from a news website or from a news programme and play that little bit of audio as a way of critiquing what has been said or by pulling it apart. And historically, we've always had the right to use news clips, to use audio, to use voices recorded on television and radio programmes for the purposes of criticism. It's always been permitted. But with this, it's going to be the end of that. And that will, of course, put a big dent in this particular programme and my ability to do it. That's what's coming down the line. Talked about this before. I'm going to leave it there because I'm sure tomorrow, maybe Thursday, I'll be getting into this in more detail and explaining with the help of somebody who knows, maybe the aforementioned Hayden Hewitt, what it means for you, what it means for me, and what it means for the independent media, right? Right, Jeremy Vine, the BBC and vaccines. Jeremy Vine is a BBC television and radio presenter. And he's got a programme that airs between midday and 2 p.m. on BBC Radio 2. Before we hear some of that programme, you may or may not know that the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, wants new legislation to force social media companies to remove content promoting false information about vaccines. So all the stuff posted by Glaxo and by Merck that say that vaccines are safe, presumably those ads are going to be deleted and the Facebook accounts of Glaxo and Merck are going to be shut down. No, of course not. Facebook accounts and Twitter accounts and YouTube accounts of those who question the efficacy, first of all, and the safety of vaccines are going to be targeted. The health secretary said the government is working with internet companies to identify misleading material on vaccines, including the MMR one. They're planning on using artificial intelligence programs to help root out what they call bad science. And they're blaming the decline in the uptake rates of the MMR vaccine in many countries. Here's BBC Radio 2's Jeremy Vine. Got a little bit of stuff to play for you here. Very important, this. You know, it connects to so many other things we talk about on this programme. Free speech, freedom of thought. This is Jeremy Vine today.
But the last few years, something strange has been happening. Take-up of the MMR vaccine in the UK has dropped again.
He's very excited, isn't he?
Again. And it's similar elsewhere. Last year in Europe, cases of measles tripled. At the same time, the so-called anti-vax movement, including those who wrongly believe the MMR vaccine to be dangerous, has been exploiting social media to spread its message. And this is where the government comes in. Matt Hancock, the health secretary, saying, right, we want to crack down on this. We want to be able to intrude on conversations we don't like on places like Facebook and just wipe them. So give us a call, 08000 288 291. Tell us if this is too much or whether actually, no, he has every right to do that.
I don't think he has every right to do that. It's interesting the way Vine phrased it. Matt Hancock wants to wipe conversations that are critical of vaccines on Facebook. Conversations. So you could genuinely be talking to your Uncle Peter or your Auntie Mary, honestly. And you could be saying, well, I read a very interesting book about vaccines, or I heard a very interesting report from a Californian doctor on the Richie Allen Show about vaccines. I'm strongly thinking of not vaccinating our newborn child when he or she is born. And what they want to do is they want to wipe that. Right. Delete that comment. Can't have that. Here's Hugh Pym. Hugh Pym is the BBC's health editor. He was on with Vine today.
And health authorities around the world, not just in the UK, are very concerned about this. Social media is a very powerful force. Information and misinformation can get mixed up, fake news, misleading claims. And as you've been saying, the uptake of the MMR vaccine has been falling in many countries in Europe. In England, it was 87.2%, down consistently over 4 years. As you said, 95% is so-called herd immunity, when a population is deemed to be safe if you get that level of vaccines. And the fact that measles cases in Europe tripled to 82,500 in just 1 year has caused real alarm bells to ring.
That's bullshit, by the way. And I've heard this said on several television and radio programmes over the last 6 months. None of them have offered any proof of this. It's just, say it enough times and it enters the lexicon. Say it enough times and it enters people's consciousness. Oh, measles all over the place in Europe. And of course, there used to be a time when the presenter would say, how do you know that? Not anymore. If somebody from the World Health Organization or from the health ministry is saying it, it must be true, so let's not challenge it. But it isn't true. Measles is not on the rise and it hasn't broken out all over Europe. It's nonsense. More from Hugh Pym, BBC Health Editor.
Ring. So Matt Hancock is saying, look, we need to do more. We need to work with social media to take this misleading content away. But there is legislation over a duty of care for social media companies to act on material linked to suicide and self-harm and terrorism. There's going to be a legislation on that. Vaccine material, anti-vaccine campaigning should be deemed to be part of that as well.
So why have the rates dropped in the rest of the EU? Because I obviously the Wakefield thing is going back 20 years now, so it's not that.
Yes, the vaccination rates did drop after that and then picked up again.
Yeah.
And it was deemed not to be an issue anymore. The theory is linking the MMR jab to autism had been totally discredited and disproved. That did...
No, they haven't.
That did go on, actually, in the courts for some years. It seems to be more of an international thing now with other campaigners who've been raising the issue. But it's hard to actually say there's causation here.
Might be complacency,
but
I guess.
Complacency and some sort of correlation. And actually, in a confusing world when parents are hearing so many different things coming through social media, it's very hard to sort of for some to chart a way forward. And there is a view maybe you don't want to take heavy-handed action here. Dr. Fiona Godley, editor of the British Medical Journal, was making the point to me, you need to win hearts and minds because you've got a spectrum. Some people convinced that there's something wrong with vaccination, others who are quite happy to have their children vaccinated, but a group in the middle who are well-meaning, intelligent people who just need reassurance. And maybe the way to do it is positive campaigning on social media rather than trying to shut down one bit of the argument. It's a big debate.
Positive campaigning. It's a big debate, he said there at the end. Positive campaigning rather than shutting down those who dissent. Here's the thing that intrigues me, and maybe you've considered this yourself. Do people think... And by people, I mean the ordinary folk like you and me, our neighbours, our peers. Did they imagine that Matt Hancock, the health secretary, came up with this proposal by himself or in consultation with his staff at the Ministry of Health? Do people actually think that's what goes on? You know, they meet 3-4 times a week, Matt Hancock and his staff. And they throw ideas out on the table about how to improve the health of the nation. Do people think that at one of these meetings, a staffer says, you know, there's a problem on the internet with people saying vaccines are unsafe. Let's introduce legislation to ban people from saying that. And the way we do that is we encourage the social media companies to delete the accounts. Do people really think that morons like Matt Hancock come up with this stuff by themselves? Can people be that ignorant? Not stupid, remember, stupid is wrong. There isn't an intelligence issue here, it's ignorance. Are people so ignorant that they don't know that Matt Hancock and his pals get their marching orders from the World Health Organization, which is staffed, by the way, with many men and women who have been on the boards of the biggest pharmaceutical companies in the world. I wonder, does it ever occur to people? Jesus, where did you come up with that one, Matt? Well, I didn't, actually. I got a phone call from Sweden, or wherever the headquarters of the WHO is, and they just tell me what to do, and I just do it because I'm just a puppet, that's all, a fucking puppet. I'll do whatever I'm told. Wouldn't you, if you're getting paid, you know, £250,000 a year, and if they promised you that when you leave government that you'll get to work on all of these various boards and committees and all your children's futures will be secured and all the rest of it? Wouldn't you do it? No, well, I actually wouldn't, to be honest. I wouldn't. I wouldn't tell people that things are safe when I don't know if they're safe or not. That's what Matt Hancock does. Gets his marching orders from one of the most corrupt institutions on planet Earth, the World Health Organization. There you are. Lovely. Imagine people actually think that Hancock dreams this up. Wow. Then, to my amazement, Jeremy Vine introduces a guy called David Robert Grimes, a physicist, not a doctor, nor a biologist, nor a chemist, a physicist. Now, David Robert Grimes and I have a little bit of history. There was a bit of a Twitter spat about a year and a half ago when Grimes began accusing Irish mothers of being child abusers because those mothers were questioning vaccine safety. Grimes is about the worst of the worst and refused to come on this programme and debate me about vaccine safety and efficacy. And he laughably says to Jeremy Vine today, and this is extraordinary stuff even by David Robert Grimes standards, and this is a wretched scumbag fucking coward who trolls women on Twitter and accuses them of child abuse because they have questions about what the HPV vaccine might have done to their daughters. This wretched coward who wouldn't debate me or anybody else. So he goes on to the relative safety of the Jeremy Vine show and listen to what he says. He says, we people, basically, aren't able to discern for ourselves what is true and what isn't true because we're not as clever as the Oxford-educated David Robert Grimes. And his Oxford degree is as worthless as the fucking paper it was printed on when they gave it to him, when he posed for the picture with his girlfriend or his boyfriend and his mammy and his daddy waving in the audience. Worthless! Doesn't matter whether it's Oxford, Manchester University, Salford University, where I went, and other places. It's a regurgitation society. Come in and show us that you can regurgitate everything we fill your fucking empty head with, and then we'll give you a nice piece of paper and a 2-1 or a master's. This guy's a moron. He says here, we are not capable of deciding for ourselves that which is correct and that which isn't.
There's a lot of research that suggests that we think we're very savvy, all of us, and we think we can differentiate signal from noise quite well. Unfortunately, the data we have to date shows that people are very, very bad at ascertaining what is reliable information and what is misinformation. And for many, many years, a dedicated core of anti-vaccine activists have exploited our uncertainty about this. So there is a very good argument for saying, well, actually, if you're perpetuating misinformation that could be harmful to public health and has no factual basis whatsoever, should you be allowed to do that? And I suppose that's a more nuanced conversation than just banning things outright, but it certainly is a complicated question.
Well, I suppose it's the question of whether Facebook, for example, has the status of just an informal conversation in the pub where somebody says, oh, I don't think those things work. And for a lot of people, it does. It's just chat. It doesn't have to be factually based.
Right. Facebook is basically, most of the time, like an informal chat around the pub. Why should it be factually based conversations? Man United are the best team in the world, says the presenter of this radio programme. They're not, of course, or anything like it, sadly. What do you do? Is that misinformation? Do you stop that? Good point by Jeremy Vine. Why should Facebook be interfering in private conversations or anybody else and deleting people because somebody has decided that something incorrect or something not factual has been said? What does David Robert Grimes, dickhead, the physicist, what does he say to that?
Well, you would be right if you were just talking about people having conversations and little comments. But a lot of these groups that are pushing these anti-vaccine messages are very, very dedicated groups. They are some pages like Stop Mandatory Vaccinations, for example, are major hub centres. And they sent out memes and ideas that scare people. So the vast majority of parents that choose not to vaccinate their children are not dyed-in-the-wool anti-vaxxers. They're just frightened parents who have seen these scary things. Which kind of...
Yeah, scary things like hundreds and hundreds of teenage girls in Ireland collapsing with debilitating mystery illnesses that turn them from outgoing, healthy, athletic, up and at them young girls into bedridden. Maybe that's the scary fucking shit that people are seeing that makes them think twice about giving vaccines to their children, maybe.
Which kind of originate from these anti-vaccine hubs. And there is a very good argument that these anti-vaccine hubs themselves are doing huge damage by doing that. Now, they've been exploiting that since even back in the days of Wakefield when the internet was in its relative infancy. That was starting to happen then. But with the advent of social media, it has become orders of magnitude easier for people that are really trying to cause harm to cause harm. And you could look at it as akin to how we regulate hate speech, for example. Stuff that is, you know, there's a division between free speech and, you know, damaging speech. And people can have conversations and should be asking questions. But the answers to those questions matters. And the motivations of the people, you know, purporting to have the answers matters as well.
Yeah. So, yes, the answer is yes, Jeremy. I do advocate Facebook or Instagram or Twitter intervening and deleting a conversation between two people, like a conversation you might be having in the pub, conversation where one person says, I'm a bit worried about vaccines. I think I'll be exempting my daughter, thank you. At that point, David Robert Adolf Hitler Grimes wants the institution that is the social media company to delete the conversation. Wow. It's the definition of fascism, isn't it? Then Grimes amazingly says that there's no need to fear your very young infant child getting lots of vaccines at once. You've got to hear this to believe it. Don't worry about your child getting a load of vaccines in the one go. No problem. That's all been debunked, says the Oxford-educated physicist David Robert Grimes.
There's an idea that you get an immune system overload if you get all these vaccinations at once. And that...
Where did that come from?
It's debunked. Any immunologist will tell you that is just not...
Hang on a second. Let's hear this again.
There's an idea that you get an immune system overload if you get all these vaccinations at once. And that is debunked. Any immunologist will tell you that is just not true. Now, freedom of speech is a really loaded term here. Because it depends if we're talking about what we're encountering on social media versus these things. But these are myths. So people have the right to believe them. But whether they should be catered to and allowed indulged in them, I'm not sure that's really...
Yeah, I mean, I suppose they're saying...
We're talking about thought crime here. People can believe them, but whether they should be catered to or indulge, I'm not sure that's a good idea. This is thought crime. Grimes is putting forward an argument for the invasion of a sovereign human being and his or her right to say, no, I will not be injected with a toxic tidal wave of fucking shit that could destroy me or destroy my child. Especially as you wanted to inoculate me against something which is not the end of the world if I get like the flu or the measles. So I'll say no, thank you very much, but thanks for the interest in my health and in my well-being. What Grimes wants is to remove your sovereign right as a sentient, completely individual, free person to say, no, I'm not having it, thanks.
They're seeing it as the same as somebody says, you know, E.T. was the best film and someone else says, no, it was Jaws. And they're seeing it as a genuine disagreement of view. But you see it as facts versus lies.
I do. And I also see it as something that's fundamentally quite selfish because...
It's selfish now to exempt yourself from vaccination or your child. It's very selfish.
Vaccination isn't just for you and me and the people who choose to get vaccinated. We have diseases like measles that have an or not, or like an infection rate of 12 to 18, which means that every person that gets measles, 12 to 18 other people will get it from that person. So
bullshit.
Person. So it's incredibly virulent. And the reason we have these ideas like herd immunity is you're trying to protect people who can't be vaccinated. Very small children or people going through chemotherapy who are immunocompromised. You know, society as a whole. So when people say, oh, this is my freedom of speech, it's my choice. Well, that's kind of true. But if you...
Kind of true?
But if you suddenly give someone, a pregnant woman, rubella, and her fetus comes out deformed, I mean...
You're a murderer!
Whose responsibility is that? So you can take it an extreme libertarian slant on it, but in reality, you got to look at the fact that we're all part of society and it matters cohesively as a whole what we do.
Mm. No room for the individual. Your rights, your sovereign right to refuse your body to be stuck with that toxic tidal wave I mentioned, doesn't matter. If we make up some bullshit that you are a danger to everyone else for not being vaccinated, you've got to do what you're told. And you heard that first bit, didn't you? That bit about lots of vaccines at once not being dangerous. You did hear that, right?
There's an idea that you get an immune system overload if you get all these vaccinations at once. And that is debunked. Any immunologist will tell you that is just not true.
Mm. Back in 2015, I was introduced to a New York woman called Alyssa Nethery. Amazing woman. Whose baby boy, Bentley, died 5 days after he was vaccinated. 13 times. Do you remember this? Alyssa Nethery, speaking exclusively to the Richie Allen Show back in early 2015.
My son, Bentley, was almost 6 months old. I had held off on having him vaccinated. I guess you can say I just didn't have a very good feeling about it. I held off until he was 6 months old. I had read somewhere that the SIDS rate for boys lowers at that age, which is sudden infant death, so the rate was supposedly lower. So I just held off until then to have him vaccinated, and I took him in, and the doctor had instructed me that we were only going to do his 2 month doses and then after that get him caught up. Well, what the doctor didn't tell me was that he was going to go ahead and add an extra dose of the DTaP, which he was already getting one, which is a 3-in-1, and then so he added an extra dosing onto that, so that put 6 doses right there. And then he had informed me that Bentley hadn't had any of his oral rotavirus vaccines, so he told me that he would only be having one since at 6 months was the last time that you were to get the doses for that. What he didn't tell me was that he was going to give him all 3 doses. I later found this out when I went up to the doctor's office to get the medical record from that day. He did give him the other shots as well that go along with the two-month doses, but, you know, he doubled and tripled on some of them, which 13 altogether is just entirely way too many. I mean, I think one is too many, but, you know, they've never studied the safety of what the combined doses will do when you give multiple shots together. So, you know, I think it's just dangerous all in all. But my son lived for 5 days after the vaccines. Throughout that time, after the vaccines were given, we were sent straight home. Usually, the nurse will keep you in the office for about 15 minutes after receiving any medicine or vaccinations, which they didn't with us. They just let us go. By the time I got my son home, which was probably about 20 minutes after he received his vaccines, I noticed a really large red knot on his leg from where he had the first batch of the DTaP. Well, it was mixed together in the syringe, but it was a very large amount of vaccine in the syringe, and I guess that's from what the red knot was on his leg, which is automatically an adverse reaction. But you know, I didn't know. They didn't send me home with any paperwork or anything, so I had nothing really to refer back to. He was cranky, which babies do get cranky after vaccinations, but you know, I thought it was just typical. Throughout the 5 days, I started noticing he would twitch some. I didn't know that it was a seizure, because baby seizures and adult or older child seizures, it's different. He began to be kind of limp on one side. And this was all within 5 days. Then the last day, the day he passed away, which was April 10th, he seemingly started feeling a little bit better. And then around noontime, my daughter laid down for a nap. He has an older sister. And we haven't vaccinated her since she was 1 year old, and she's actually been extremely healthy. But she laid down for a nap, and my son started to get tired, so I just held him on my chest like I did all the time, and he fell asleep, and he just never woke up. And, you know, it was very chaotic after that. It was awful. His cause of death was ruled as SUDS, not SIDS. It's sudden unexpected death syndrome. And nothing to do with the vaccines was ever brought up. They would never admit it, you know, to begin with. So, you know, pretty much just left, you know, stuck with no answers. And I'm currently in the process of trying to gather enough funds together right now to find an attorney who would be able to assist me with, you know, I believe
medical negligence. It's a fight that still goes on today for Alyssa Nethery. They said SUDS, sudden unexplained death syndrome. And while they acknowledge that the boy was given 13 inoculations in one day, right? They incredibly decided to say that there was no correlation between the 5 days, the deterioration of the boy's condition and his health to the point where he died. No correlation between that, those 13 vaccines and Andy's death. And David Robert Grimes will tell you there's no evidence that overloading a baby with vaccines is dangerous. Well, that could be the exception, Richie. Well, in fact, it isn't, because I could have dug out another half a dozen women who've come on this programme to talk about their children becoming seriously and grievously ill after receiving multiple vaccinations in one day. David Robert Grimes either doesn't know that information, and to give him his due, got to be honest, he might not. If he does, well, then he's a stone-cold liar when he says that there isn't any evidence that overloading a child with those vaccines could be very dangerous. It's beyond dangerous. And then this guy Grimes tells Jeremy Vine. Now, this guy's a physicist, allegedly, not a doctor, not a virologist, not a paediatrician, not a biologist, not a chemist. He brings up the HPV vaccine, which is the human papillomavirus vaccine, which is beyond controversial in Ireland and elsewhere. Do you think Jeremy Vine does his job? Do you think when Grimes brings up HPV that Jeremy Vine says, well, hang on a second, weren't you embroiled in some controversy in Ireland when women were saying the vaccine harmed their daughters and you were calling them child abusers, David Robert Grimes? Do you think he does his job, Jeremy Vine? Have a listen. Yeah, we should be hearing that clip now. Give me a second there, I'll bring it up for you now. So this is where Grimes brings up the HPV vaccine.
We look at other things, like we have the HPV vaccine, which prevents, you know, cancers. It prevents genital cancers. And we don't look at that in context. It's not about, you know, these potential for minute chances of harm.
Minute chances of harm. Hundreds. Maybe more than 1,000 Irish teenagers. Immune systems destroyed by exposure to Gardasil. Left with debilitating mystery illnesses that make them bedridden and wheelchair-bound in many cases. In some cases, let's be honest. Minute problems, says Grimes. And at this point, Vine should be jumping in and saying, hold on there a second now, let's bring a bit of balance to this. What about regret.ie? What about that controversy? But Jeremy Vine, well,
it's really about what does vaccination prevent us against? What is, if we balance up the probability of protection versus damage, vaccines score tremendously positively for helping us.
This guy is not a virologist, not an immunologist, not a biologist, not a chemist, not a paediatrician. This guy describes himself as a physicist. And yet again, Vine hasn't reminded the audience that this guy is not an expert. Not an expert. He's a campaigner. That's all he is. He's an activist for vaccines, not an expert, and has no right to be approved by Jeremy Vine in his programme as an expert in the field of immunology or vaccine safety. And yet he drones on, and Vine doesn't stop him. But Vine does stop him here and drops a proper bombshell. Listen to this by Jeremy Vine.
I'll just tell you some of the Hugh Pym.
An amazing story that just came across the BBC news desk today.
Just found out as he was leaving the studio, and the BBC health editor very kindly passed it on to us. You may not have seen this yet, David, which is from New York State and Rockland County in New York.
So Rockland County in New York have made a law about vaccines. Wait till you hear this.
New York State is declaring a state of emergency in response.
A state of emergency now in Rockland County in New York State. They've declared a state of emergency. Why?
Response to a severe outbreak of measles, and it starts at midnight on Wednesday, March 27th, so tomorrow. And from midnight tomorrow, anybody who's under 18 and hasn't had the measles vaccine is going to be barred from all public places.
What did he just say there? He couldn't have said that.
Tomorrow, anybody who's under 18 and hasn't had the measles vaccine is going to be barred from all public places.
What are you doing out, boy? I'm just going to the store. You been vaccinated, boy? No. Get your fucking self home then, boy. It's all come true, hasn't it? Hasn't it? Every dystopian film, every fucking book that said the world would end up like this, it's arrived. Rockland County in New York. If you're under 18 and you haven't been vaccinated, you're banned from public places. It's a tyranny. What does David Robert Grimes think of that? Surely that's a step too far, even for the fascist, sorry, the physicist, David Robert Grimes, surely.
What do you think about that?
I think that's a good idea. I mean, this goes back to the social contract.
Oh.
Choose not to get vaccinated, but you shouldn't be able to harm other people because of that. So if you don't want to play by that kind of level of social contract, I should point out that America had mandatory vaccinations for years, but they've seen an increase in religious and political exemptions. And in those kind of centres is where you're seeing these massive outbreaks. New York has hit its 21-year high. So it is an epidemic, it's an incredibly virulent disease, and we cannot be complacent about it.
David Robert Grimes. A know-nothing, masqueraded by the BBC as an expert in immunology and in vaccine efficacy and safety, when he's a physicist allegedly. I say allegedly because I don't know if he practices physics, if physics and his knowledge of it makes, you know, makes up his daily life, if he works in some field of engineering or physics or whatever. Not a doctor, not a paediatrician, not a virologist, not an immunologist, not a biologist, but rolled out by the BBC and RTE, Radio Telefíseann in Ireland, as somebody who is an expert in this field, even though he isn't. And because, I mean, I'm getting tweeted now, and people, I know, people are absolutely scratching their heads. People are scratching their heads. That can't be right, Richie. That cannot be right, that. What you just heard there, that under-18s are banned, effectively, from leaving the house in Rockwell County in New York. It can't be true. You know, it can't be. Tom, did you hear that, Tom?
No. Could you repeat it? Because I can't believe my fucking ears.
Let's repeat it. This is what Jeremy Vine said.
Which is from New York State, and Rockland County in New York State is declaring a state of emergency in response to a severe outbreak of measles. And it starts at midnight on Wednesday, March 27th, so tomorrow. And from midnight tomorrow, anybody who's under 18 and hasn't had the measles vaccine is going to be barred from all public places. What do you think about that?
I think that's a good idea. I mean, this goes back to the social contract. You can choose not to get vaccinated, but you shouldn't be able to harm other people because...
Yeah, David Robert Grimes there. World-class fuckwit on The Richie Allen Show for Tuesday, March 26, 2019. Let's lock everybody up who doesn't do what the government tells them to do. Lock them all fucking up and throw away the key. This is Joy Division, back with more in 2 minutes. Nice music from Joy Division there. Lovell Terrace Barrett. Kevin Barrett will be on the programme in about 5 minutes' time when he signs in there and bids me good day, sir. Nobody says good day anymore, do they? Good day, good day, good day to you. Good day to you, madam. Good day to you, sir. You don't get any of that anymore, do you? You don't get hello, full stop, do you, Annie? I noticed that, yeah. I noticed that when you're out and about now. Don't make eye contact with anybody, Jesus, no. You can't. Most of the time, they're not looking forward anyway. They're looking down at the phone in their left hand. Right? Good luck trying to get something out of somebody. How you doing? Don't even hear you. Thank you for the days. Rich tweets, Richie, you have said it yourself. Your audience is decent, but the size of the mainstream media audience is massive. Yes, the MSM will be the only thing available before long. That's right. We get excited sometimes. When I say we, there are one or two people who help me with this programme. Not producing it, not editing it, but with the logistics of getting it on air. Thinking of Paul and Hayden and Tez and one or two others. And we do marvel sometimes. We don't pat ourselves on the back. We're not arrogant. Not at all. So, wow, we're doing well. This week, hundreds of thousands of downloads on the podcast. Big numbers in the evening. It's good. Yeah, it has an audience. It's good. And then we realise it's not even a grain of sand on a beach. And that makes you a bit depressed sometimes. You know, because it isn't about ego. It's not about who's got the biggest tally whacker. It's not about that. Oh, I'm better than him because I've got more listeners. It's not about that at all. It's nonsense. So it's like, it's nice to know that people are listening to it. And then you realise, well, have you even made a scratch on the Hoover Dam with a little pin, have you? Maybe not. But maybe we're not meant to. Maybe all of us that make decent programmes, and there are plenty of decent programmes out there, maybe we're destined to be Neo in the Matrix in terms of the architect says, listen, you guys have been here 100,000 times and you've always failed to bring down this system. And we just have to find new and wonderful ways of bringing down the system. But yes, you're right. It's a very good point you're making there, Rich. John Parsons tweets, all very depressing and scary, Richie. What do I tell my kids? Should I try and encourage free thought? Because that way lies an unhappy life as they watch helpless. Maybe the final lines of Orwell's novel are a tutorial. Accept the madness, love Big Brother. That's a very deep question and it's a very good question, John. And thanks for bringing that up. That question has plagued me for years. Are you better to swallow the other pill? Where you go back into the dream world and where you value having money to go and watch the football, where you value splashing out money on crazy consumerist shit that you don't need, where you value being on social media all day long and getting gratification from some fucking nobody in Alaska who liked your tweet. Is ignorance bliss? Are you better off? It's a great question. I don't know, mate, to be honest. Anyway, shall we say hello to the genius that is Kevin Barrett? It's a word we don't use lightly. He is a genius. He's a broadcaster, an author, a journalist. You can find him at truthjihad.com. He's an old friend of mine, and Kevin is one of the first guests that came on my programmes way back when I began making them in Spain, and he's been with me ever since, and I'm proud that he is. Top man, let's welcome back Kevin Barrett. Very busy these last few days. Kevin, welcome back. Thanks for sparing the time, pal. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you, Richie. It's always great to be on your show. Really one of my favorite shows by far.
Thanks, mate. I appreciate you saying that. Now, before we talk about Palestine and what's happening there at the moment, it was interesting that five opposition parties in the UK wrote a letter to the UK government condemning the constant and continued sale of arms to Saudi Arabia, arms which are being used to indiscriminately murder Yemeni folks. The UN says tens of thousands. You and I are old hats. Kevin, we know if they're saying tens of thousands, it's probably six figures. People blown to pieces, never to see the light of day again. There was a question asked by Emily Thornberry, the Shadow Foreign Secretary, today. She asked a foreign secretary minister, a guy called Mark Field, she asked him, is it true that British military personnel who are in Saudi Arabia have witnessed war crimes committed by the Saudis? Because that would put the UK in a very precarious legal position. Needless to say, Kevin, the puppet Foreign Office minister just wouldn't say anything, wouldn't give any sort of a proper answer at all. Is it positive that Jeremy Corbyn's party have finally decided to speak out about what's happening in Yemen? What do you think? What have you made of that news?
Yes, I think that's great news. And I think Jeremy Corbyn's party is ahead of most of the parties in the West at getting these issues right. And we're seeing a little bit more of this sort of thing with, you know, the Ilhan Omar controversies here in the United States, where there are more and more people getting closer to actual positions of power who sometimes tell a little bit of truth. And we've had Congress here in the United States as well voting against helping the Saudis commit these genocidal war crimes in Yemen. And you're right, the real number of victims is a lot more than a few thousands. It's more like, well, the official figures are that I think it's well over 10 million Yemenis are threatened with imminent starvation due to the blockade. The Saudis have cut off the food supplies and medical supplies and everything else coming into much of Yemen. So it's nice to see somebody talking about this and saying we have to stop, but this has been going on for many years, and it's been horrendously bad, years ago. So where were all these people, and what's their plan to actually do something about it?
That's a good point, Kevin, because as an activist, I mean, you've been an activist as much as a journalist and an academic as you are, and an author, and you've put the case for the Palestinian people for years and years and years. So you will know all about Jeremy Corbyn, who he is and who he was before he became Labour leader. A lot of people in the anti-war movement in the UK have up to this point been incredibly disappointed with the leadership, or the lack of it, by Jeremy Corbyn, because a lot of people thought when he won the Labour leadership, but more importantly, when he was challenged and he won again in a landslide, rubber stamping his authority as the rightful leader of the Labour Party, anti-war campaigners and activists thought, well, this is great. Now, finally, we're going to get somebody at the dispatch box saying the things that, you know, need to be said. And I've had some of them on the programme in the last couple of weeks, and they've said, well, we've been very disappointed with Corbyn up to this point. What do you think?
Well, he does seem to have backed down a little bit when challenged by this onslaught of angry Zionists who can't handle the fact that Corbyn is on record saying some sensible things about Israel. And of course, they're even more horrified that Corbyn is on record as a closet 9/11 truther. He's a friend of the late Michael Meacher, and there are some others apparently that all know about 9/11 being a false flag. Michael Meacher was the one who went up above the radar and spoke out publicly and was chased out of public life in the UK because of that. But Corbyn has, I believe there are actually some news stories about this. People can look at it. So some of this has actually even surfaced in the mainstream media. So I think Corbyn, with his awareness of what's going on in the world, including his awareness of the hideousness of the entire Zionist enterprise, is a real threat. And they've obviously been going after him with all guns blazing. And I would like to see him stand up and open up on them and fight back, just like I would like to see Ilhan Omar refuse to apologize a lot more than she has. She sort of alternately backed down and then refused to apologize and then backed down again and so on, this kind of wavering vacillation. And my preference is for standing firm. And there's even some research about dissent that when dissidents stand firm and don't back down, don't change, they actually have better long-term success. So I would have preferred to see him be a lot firmer and call out the Zionists and even up the ante. I think he could rally a majority of the British people behind him if he did that. But we're all socialized to be terrified of what other people think of us and to be terrified about them calling names. And then if the people doing that are extremely wealthy and powerful and working in concert, it could get even worse. So I can understand why he has been timid, and I share these people's wish that he weren't so timid.
Fascinating talking about Michael Meacher there, I interviewed Michael several times over the years and I really liked him, had a lot of time for him. And I'm very intrigued by the idea that Jeremy Corbyn expressed some reservations about the coverage of the of September 11th and the idea that Corbyn maybe didn't believe the official story. I'm fascinated by that. I have interviewed Jeremy's brother Piers a few times, but it's generally been about Piers' field of expertise, which is the weather. He's a meteorologist. But I know that Piers himself personally has often spoken publicly about false flag attacks and all the rest of it. Fascinating man is Piers Corbyn. Kevin, I'm sure you'd enjoy, you might have had him on your programme, Kev, for all I know, but he'd make, that'd be a great conversation, you speaking with Piers Corbyn. Now, this is where I get stuck into you on behalf of my Jewish listeners, and I do have a few, and my Israeli listeners, and I do have a few. They love you coming on, and they expect me to give you a few digs, so I'm going to give you a dig. Much as I love you, I'm going to give you a dig.
How many shekels are they paying you?
How many shekels? Yeah. When somebody says shekels, I think Life of Brian. I think the haggling over the gourd. Don't get into right. that. I start giggling. Right. I watched you on Press TV yesterday. Good stuff. Interesting interview. Interesting debate you had there. And you said that the claim that seven British Israelis were injured by a rocket was false, that it didn't happen, that it was an Israeli false flag operation. Now, because my audience knew in advance you were coming on, one of my Jewish listeners said, get stuck into him, Richie. The Jewish listener said to me, I'm not saying that Israel hasn't done stuff in the past as a pretext or as an excuse for going into Gaza. I'm not saying that's impossible. But every time something happens, it can't always be Israeli false flag. It can't always be the Israelis' fault. A broken clock is even right twice a day. How do you know for a fact, and you can't say you do now, my friend, that it was a false flag, that it didn't come from Gaza?
Well, first, I don't mischaracterize me and say I don't think anybody was injured. That's not true at all.
Fair enough. My apologies.
I would assume that there really was a rocket fired from Gaza and that people really were injured. Although I'm not sure of that, but that's there's no reason to not think that. But why was that rocket fired? There is a long-term history of these things happening at moments that are advantageous for certain Israeli propaganda purposes, and especially this sort of hard right, like Kudnik, Jabotinsky wing of the Zionist enterprise. I mentioned repeatedly Thomas Suarez's State of Terror in that interview on Press TV yesterday. And if you read that book, you'll see that terrorism has been weaponized by the Zionists as their most basic kind of go-to tool of getting what they want and achieving their success in this really difficult enterprise. I mean, in a sense, you do have to kind of hand it to them. They're underdogs in the sense that how can 8 million people, that's the population of Israel, and maybe fewer than 6 million are Jewish and far fewer than that are really Jewish. How can such a tiny fraction of the population take over the biggest powers in the world and use them to establish this so-called Jewish state in land that is holy to almost 4 billion people, you know, more than half the world's population? This is an amazing project that they've been able to pull off. And to do that, they've really had to use all sorts of extraordinary measures, including terrorism and especially false flag terrorism. But in terms of this particular rocket attack or alleged rocket attack, I have no reason to say that it didn't happen or that nobody got injured. It happened at the perfect time for Netanyahu. Netanyahu was over here in the U.S. confabbing with Trump. Netanyahu's message as he goes into this hotly contested election that he's very in the worst political danger of his life is that I have reestablished Israeli control over the United States. Under Obama, the U.S. was turning away from supporting my Likudnik Jabotinsky version of ever expanding greater Israel. But now we have placed Trump in the White House. He didn't have to come out and say that we are the ones who hacked the elections to give him the swing states to do it, but they did. And
we don't know they did.
We do know that.
You might suspect it, but we can't prove it, right?
it would be a statistical fluke if that weren't the case. In any case, what Bibi's saying, whether or not you accept the election fraud part of it,
yeah,
is that we are back in control of the United States. We have a reliable puppet pushing the extremist Likudnik line out of the White House. He has just endorsed our theft of Jerusalem. He has endorsed our theft of the Golan Heights. All of this in the teeth of the entire world that's raging against this. It has no use for Trump and no use for this nonsense, but our man in the White House has stood up for us in Israel, and here we are, and Bibi's beating his chest, and oh, now we're under attack again. These horrible terrorists are raining down rockets on some shopping complex and residential area. Oh, I've got to rush back to Israel and beat my chest and be the big alpha male leader. And guess what? That's likely to deliver him the election. Given the timing, given who benefits, how can anyone not think that this is an obvious false flag?
It's a good, yeah, look, it's, as a theory, it's very plausible, I'll give you that. And it's happened before, I'll give you that. As for the election, again, as a theory, it's plausible. The Russian collusion thing was largely nonsense. Not saying for a minute.
No, it wasn't. Trump has been fronting for the Russian mafia throughout his entire career.
Yeah,
that's his only job he's ever held, is fronting for
the
Kosher Nostra, which is mainly Russian now.
Yeah, I wasn't saying that. But the point I'm making was the idea that the Russian government, that there was collusion between Trump and his people and the Russian government in trying to swing the election. I don't believe that. However, I do believe that Trump was more palatable to Russia and certain other states than Clinton was. But I also don't think we can underestimate the revulsion that Americans had for Hillary Clinton, for some very, very good reasons. And this brash guy came along, this amazing social media campaign, convincing the world that he was genuinely an outsider and going to go after the deep state. I do believe a lot of people went for that. Now, I know you believe strongly that there was a very strong Israeli hand in that, and I'm not saying there wasn't, but I'm just saying what we can prove and conjecture are two different things, but I hear you. I hear you loud and clear. As for the Golan Heights, I've had Israelis say to me, we won the Six-Day War, the spoils of war, tough shit, Paddy. That's just the way it goes. And Trump was only acknowledging what's factual anyway. We've controlled it for 40 years. That's the way it's going to be. What do you say to that?
Well, two things. One is that if we want to live in a world of perpetual warfare, where all of those, and that's more than a billion people, I think, who are as horrified by what Israel has done throughout its checkered history as I am, we'll spend the rest of our lives and generations and thousands of years, if necessary, to get these bastards that did it, you know, in any way possible, in a world full of more and more powerful biological weapons, nuclear weapons, and all sorts of other weapons. If you want to have billions of people coming after you for the rest of human history on Earth, fine, let's have a world where it's the war of all against all and watch humanity destroy itself. But if you want to have a world where people can work things out and be reasonable, that's a world where you can't steal territory with war anymore.
Yeah.
And those are our only two choices. And the whole world has said, we want a world where you can't steal territory with war anymore. That's the world we've been in since World War II, since Nuremberg. And unfortunately for the Israelis, their genocidal thefts happened in 1948 and then again in 1967 and 1973. That's after the world said no more stealing territory with war. So they have two choices. They can be exterminated in a long-term war of all against all, in which much of the planet hates them personally more than anyone else, or they can live peacefully with their neighbors by accepting the world in which you can't steal territory with war. I mean, those are their only two choices.
Yeah, look, I agree. I'm being the devil's advocate here. You've heard Israeli commentators speaking to American news channels saying basically what I just said, we won the war and all the rest of it. And that's the point. I don't agree with it. You know I don't agree with it. I believe Israel is illegitimate as a state. I've been saying that ever since I broke away from commercial media. It has no right to exist as a state. Not in law, anyway, it doesn't. And its only claim to right to exist is the claim that God told them that it was their land. And I don't buy any of that nonsense. And as somebody who studied history, I know all about the Sykes-Picot Agreement and the Balfour Declaration and the illegality of those treaties and documents as well. It doesn't have any right to exist. However, I've said before, you know, given the opportunity to sort it all out, I used to always say two-state solution. Now I say Palestine with the rights of Jews to thrive and exist and coexist in a state of Palestine. Anyway, look, let's stay with it. It's 25 minutes past the hour. There's loads to talk about with you today, of course, and people are asking me to get your thoughts on Christchurch as well. We might come to that in a minute. On the situation with Israel. So there were strikes yesterday. There was a tenuous ceasefire, as far as I know. There were a lot of people worried, people who watch Israel closely, who write about Palestine and the conflict, if you want to call it that, worried that because we've not had a full-scale bombardment since 2014, and of course we talked a lot about that at the time, that they're overdue. And I hate that. You know, it's a very callous, very cold thing to think about, that they're overdue to fly daily missions over Gaza and bombard it again. Does that concern you, Kevin? Are you worried about that?
Absolutely. And yeah, they are overdue. In the sort of the same way when police are hunting for a serial killer like the Zodiac Killer, and he's been killing people on the average, you know, every 3 months, and then like, you know, 4 months goes by, then yeah, the serial killer is overdue. And the Zionist serial murderers of thousands and thousands of people in Gaza, you know, are overdue for mowing the lawn again. That's what they call it, mowing down 2,000 plus civilians. And then when the Palestinian resistance tries to put up some kind of a fight against it, what do? They fire a bunch of inaccurate bottle rockets that rarely injure anybody in Israel. And then they do things like tunneling into Israel and fighting the IDF soldiers. And that's why in the last round of this in 2014, the Zionist terrorists, because that's what they are, the terrorist group called the IDF, murdered more than 2,000 Palestinian civilians and a handful of fighters, whereas the Palestinian fighters ended up killing about 60 Israelis, the vast majority of whom were actually soldiers. So the Palestinians today are not the terrorists. They are the anti-terrorists, the counter-terrorists, and the Zionists are the terrorists. The definition of terrorism is intentionally killing civilians. That's what the Zionists do every few years in Gaza, and they are indeed overdue.
Final thought on Israel for the moment. The United Nations, of course, reported very short few weeks ago that horrendous crimes were committed on the fence line. We should never call it a border, because it's not a border. It's a fence. It's an illegal fence to keep people trapped in an open-air prison, but they call it a border on the news all the time to confuse people, to program people. It isn't a border, of course. The land is Palestinian, it's Palestine. They've put a fence up there. And the UN said, yes, there's no doubt that they were shooting at youngsters. They were shooting at people who were coming to help those who had been shot. It's psychotic. And yet we get this from the UN and nothing happens. And this brings me to international law. Because I think a lot of our listeners won't have any idea about international law. They'll have heard of the ICC, of course, and, you know, every now and then some African dictator from the 70s gets brought up before it. Nobody's ever heard of him unless they're Kevin Barrett or even me, because, you know, we spend our lives reading newspapers. There's no way that any of these people, you know, can ever be brought to justice internationally, is there? It doesn't matter. I mean, Emily Thornberry said today to the Foreign Office Minister, she said, well, British soldiers might be witnessing war crimes in Yemen, meaning they're complicit, because if they're standing there watching it happen and they're not doing anything to prevent it, they're an accessory after the fact. But who or what could ever bring these people to justice? The ICC is a joke, right?
Well, it may be a joke, but it's scaring some people, apparently. Like Pompeo, for example, has panicked and announced that the ICC people will never be given any visas to come to the United States to investigate either American or Israeli war crimes. He wouldn't have to do that if the ICC was completely a joke. And I believe Pinochet had some issues with the ICC that made his life more difficult. The Argentinian junta people had some problems with the ICC. Some of the war criminals from the problems in Serbia and the former Yugoslavia have had their lives made miserable by the ICC. There are some examples here. Of course, usually it's the losing powerless side that gets hauled into the ICC. That's, of course, the Nuremberg precedent, where the horrific Nazi war crimes of World War II were prosecuted and then some, including some exaggerations of the actual crimes, where and this was all extracted under torture. You know, almost all of the so-called confessions by the Nazis were just extracted under torture, and therefore they're invalid. But indeed, the Nazis did commit war crimes, and they were prosecuted at Nuremberg. However, the equally horrendous Allied war crimes, firebombings of entire civilian cities and so on, were never prosecuted. We do need to try to move to a world where all of these crimes will be prosecuted, not just the war crimes of the relatively powerless factions, and we should all be working towards that day.
Do you know what, Kevin? You shouldn't. I mean, the United States hasn't signed up to the International Criminal Court, so Pompeo might say, it might look like Pompeo is a bit nervous, but as long as, you know, he doesn't travel in a country that might be likely to arrest him and indict him, like in the Far East, for example, he's going to be okay. But we don't need the ICC. I mean, look at what happened in this country. We had the Chilcot inquiry, which was absolutely damning and scathing in its assessment of what Tony Blair did. Blair came to Parliament and said Saddam can attack in 45 minutes. It's a pack of lies. He knew it was a pack of lies. The deep state had David Kelly murdered, the weapons inspector. Blair's tagging along with Baby Bush cost millions of people their lives in the Middle East. All of this is known. The ICC shouldn't matter. UK law should have dealt with Tony Blair, right? But it doesn't. And domestic courts in the United States should be able to deal with psychotic fucking killers. Excuse my language, I shouldn't be swearing while chatting with you. But killers like Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney. But they don't. We shouldn't need international jurisprudence. We should be able to do it in our own bloody countries.
That's a very good point. We absolutely should. We're unfortunately, though, we have a tradition of impunity for rogue elites, or, you know, elite deviants is what the criminologists call it. And elites, that is, you know, very rich and powerful people, have been getting away with crimes as a matter of course for generations. That might even be kind of the standard situation here in so-called civilization. Ever since there's been so-called civilization, the warlords who stole money from the peasants and called it taxation have been also raping the peasants and calling it droit de seigneur, the right of the nobility to do that. And today the droit de seigneur is that we can have Donald Trump and Bill Clinton both being close friends of Mossad pedophile pimp Jeffrey Epstein, who's actually convicted of this horrible crime. He victimized hundreds and hundreds of young girls, pawning them off to his rich friends, including Clinton and very likely Trump. And yet nobody seems to care. Alexander Acosta is still serving under Trump, having covered that up. And then you have Jimmy Savile in the UK. I mean, these are the kinds of examples that show you that there's been a culture of total impunity for these criminal elites. And that has to change. And I would like to see it change pretty much by any means necessary. I mean, you know, guillotines or whatever it takes pretty much needs, you know, that we need to have a complete break from that past, that element of the past that allows these elites to run roughshod over common humanity.
Yeah, you know, I disagree with the old capital punishment. It's interesting speaking to you coming from the US. Does Wisconsin have the death penalty, Kevin?
No, Wisconsin does not.
Yeah, I was wondering about, I used to be a very diligent anti-capital punishment campaigner when I was a young lad, when I was a very young student. I was very impressionable. But I used to write to death row prisoners in the States, and I got to speak to a man whom I'd been writing to for years in Jacksonville in Florida. I got to speak to him the night before he went to be lethally injected. I always hated it. I think once we go down that road, Kevin, we become as bad as them. And I think there are scriptures that deal with this in the Quran. Correct me if I'm wrong. Scriptures that deal with, you know, becoming the thing that you detest most, becoming that which is ugly and evil by imitating it or by doing it. I don't think we should ever lock them up and throw the key away. Treat them humanely. But once we get into executing them, we become as bad as them, Kevin. Just my opinion. What do you think?
Well, maybe so. You know, I guess one of the things that I am attracted to in Islam is its outlook that human nature is basically okay and the world is basically okay. There's no fallen world like in Christianity. You know, the basic message of a certain kind of Christianity is that
God created such a screwed up world. We're all sinners. Yeah,
right. Such a screwed up world. The only way to redeem the world and humanity was for God to torture his son to death.
And
that's, you know, I just can't identify with that. To me, a perfect God has to make a perfect world. And I think it is. It's a learning experience. And so our natural state and our natural impulses, which does include a lot of violence and all sorts of impulses that we do have to control as part of the test that we're undergoing here. But that all, I think, is basically okay. And so, for instance, it is okay for the loved ones of somebody who's been brutally, you know, murdered and so on to want revenge. And it's actually okay for them to take revenge, but it's better for them to forgive, especially if the situation warrants. And, you know, say what you want about the Taliban. I'm not a fan of the Taliban, and some of their stuff, some of their behavior is just insane, and they're not very well educated. They're a pretty bad example of tribal backwards Muslims. But one thing that they did that I think is actually pretty laudable is that their form of capital punishment was to take the criminal out, you know, in public in front of the victims. And then the victim's family is given the gun and they get the choice. They're urged by the authorities to be merciful and to pardon the killer. And they get that choice. And I think that's actually, that makes a lot more sense to me than these technological, you know, kind of executions that we have in states that still feature them here. But I don't think we should be afraid of our own nature that wants revenge for horrific wrongs.
No.
That's actually part of the plan.
Well, do you know, I've got a thought on that. I think when something, when some grievous, horrendous, violent crime has been perpetrated against somebody, if that person's loved ones manage to get to the person who committed the crime before the authorities, as long as they're not torturing somebody, if they kill them, I think it's wrong still, personally, but I wouldn't condemn them for it and I wouldn't send them to prison for it. What I have a big problem with is the state exacting retribution on behalf of citizens. It's interesting that, and I did read this about some Islamic leaders in some parts of the Middle East, where they would offer the victim's family the choice of retribution or clemency or mercy. And from what I understand, most of the time, the family gives mercy and says, okay, you know, we'll move on, we'll move away from it, which is an amazing thing, really. I have a big problem with the state exacting retribution. I don't believe the state has any right to put somebody to death because of some crime that you committed against me, Kevin, or I committed against you. I've got a big problem with that. But a hot-blooded crime where the victim's husband or wife or father or mother in a fit of rage gets to the person first and shoots them or whatever, we can deal with that and we can cope with it and we can figure a way forward, but not the state exacting retribution. That's just, do you want a final word on that before I ask you about Christchurch?
No, I really agree with you. And I think that some more enlightened version of that Taliban model that I mentioned earlier might be the best solution. And I don't like the state at all. I'm an Irish Muslim anarchist. That's three strikes against me already.
Yeah, no, fair enough, Kev. We'll leave that there because we've got about 10 minutes. And I wanted to talk about Christchurch. Two mosques, 50 shootings. The man accused of it wrote a manifesto that he'd been preparing it for 2 years. Some very interesting research being done by some very good journalists about his movements in Turkey and in Pakistan and elsewhere around the world. There are a lot of people not happy with the fact that there are punitive measures have been introduced for anybody who shares the video. That's very worrying. That, why would anybody? The New Zealand Prime Minister doesn't want to mention the guy's name again. All sorts of things going on there. I know you've written about it for Veterans Today. I know you've talked quite a bit about it on your own program, truthjihad.com, by the way. Check out Kevin if you haven't checked him out before. We're nearly 2 weeks since it happened. What do you think now, Kevin? What happened, do you think, and why did it happen?
Well, you know, I haven't really been able to dig into the evidence to try to see whether there are red flags indicating that something radically different happened from what we've been told. But it does look like there are the standard indications of more than one shooter. That's been something. My interpretation of many of these shootings that are sometimes considered to be total false flags, like Sandy Hook, for example, or people who say that nobody died there, I don't think so. It looks to me like there in many other places, the Nidal Hassan shooting here in the United States, and some of these other cases, it looks like there's evidence for multiple shooters. Certainly San Bernardino, where multiple witnesses said that the shooters were large white paramilitaries, three large white paramilitaries, and then they went after a Muslim couple with a diminutive little girl or woman for as one of the supposed kamikazes, et cetera, et cetera. So we have a pattern here where there are professional operations that are blamed on a lone nut patsy. And to me, this fits the bill. Whether this guy was some kind of hypnotized Manchurian candidate who did all the shooting himself, or more likely, as at least one video snippet indicates, there was at least one other shooter, I think that this was probably a real event, and it was probably orchestrated by the same kinds of professionals who were doing so many of these types of events for public relations purposes. And what those would be, I think, would be to inflame the clash of civilizations, this war between the post-Christian and Muslim worlds, and then to ramp up the internet censorship. You know, live stream atrocity is perfect for crunching the internet, and they're doing it already. They're already coming into my live YouTube broadcast and pushing the mute button the second that my guest starts talking about something that they don't want discussed. So this is way beyond.
How does that work, Kevin? This is really worrying. Tell me how that works. So I know you've got a big audience. So you're on YouTube then, you're doing your program, you've got a guest on, you're having a chat about something. What exactly is happening and who's doing it? Who's muting it and how does it work?
I wish I knew, Richie, but right, we know that this is almost certainly not a coincidence, because we've had all kinds of apparent cyber attacks trying to keep Alan Zabrowski off of the False Flag weekly news show, which is live streamed on YouTube. And after all kinds of work by cybersecurity experts who said, yes, he was under some kind of extraordinary cyber attack, we got a kind of a computer that had been kept in the deep freeze and so on. And so he was able to do the broadcast this past Friday. But when we got to the 58-minute mark at the end of the show, he started to, quote unquote, deny the Holocaust. And the only words that got out of his mouth were the Holocaust is a technological and logistical impossibility. And suddenly, click, he was muted.
He was silenced, yeah. Was he? Wow, that's very interesting, that. Yeah. I mean, yeah, wow.
And now they're trying to shut down the YouTube channel. They've disabled that video, so it's under all kinds of walls of warning you away about how dangerous it is. No comments are allowed, et cetera, et cetera. So No Lies Radio's channel is under attack over this episode. And there was nothing in whatsoever in this broadcast that could conceivably be called cyberbullying.
But the trigger might have been, I mean, you and I have spoken about this before, and nobody could ever accuse me of being a coward, and nobody could ever accuse me of saying something which I don't mean. I've been an absolutely ruthless critic of Israel, pretty much my entire broadcasting career. But not only that, I've talked at length about the exploitation of the Holocaust and the plight of Jews in Germany, and I have no problems talking about that. And I've interviewed people over the years who say that the whole thing was a big hoax that never happened, and I've argued with them, and I gave them a platform. I didn't insult them. I argued with them, as you kind of know me to do. That's fascinating, that, because as that's been happening to you, there are people who have been on this program. They've been demonized by the national media for coming on the program, but not because I've denied the Holocaust, because I haven't, because I believe Jews were murdered and interned in concentration camps in World War II. But because I've interviewed people who have genuine beliefs that it was exaggerated or whatever, and because I've done that, I then become persona non grata, so therefore the guest should never have come on. This is an amazing thing that's happening, and you're going to see this yourself as well. It's guilt by association. So Kevin Barrett interviewed somebody, and that person said something that's supposed to be heinous. It doesn't matter that Kevin Barrett argued with the guy and did a professional job of putting the other side across. The fact is, Kevin shouldn't have spoken to him. This is the way we're going now, Kev, you see. These are dangerous times, and I'm not surprised that you've had a guest on and he was going to say something about his unacceptance or lack of acceptance of the Holocaust, and bang, he was muted. I don't believe that Holocaust denial should be a crime. I don't believe that anybody should be prosecuted for it. I don't believe that a Jewish person can credibly explain to me how it could be offensive or hurtful. Call the guy an effing idiot and just ignore him if you disagree with him, but don't advocate for his arrest or losing his job. You know, I don't agree with these guys, Kev, as you know. I've said this before, but don't lock them up, don't charge them with a crime. And if they want to broadcast that, let them. We're supposed to be free to think, free to speak, regardless of whether we're right or wrong, you know. These are dangerous times.
The problem here is that Dr. Alan Sabrowski is not just some idiot Holocaust denier. He's the former head of strategic studies at the U.S. Army War College, and he's best known for having said that Israel was behind 9/11. He came out on my radio show saying that 8 years ago. And he's a very smart, thoughtful guy, and he's Jewish himself. And I don't recall exactly what part of his idea of the Holocaust being logistical and technological impossibility it was. I assume maybe he's talking about sort of the high-end estimates of people killed in gas chambers or something like that. And frankly, I don't know to what extent that people like him are wrong about some of these contentions. I've examined this issue. I urge everybody else to think about it with an open mind and, you know, read the best defenses of the official version of the Holocaust, and then read the best books asking questions about them. And on that basis, we would have a reason to have beliefs. But if we haven't done that, we don't. And it's obvious that somebody doesn't want us to actually think about this and to come to our own conclusions. That, I think, is the real issue. And yeah, I don't like people who get really angry and hate on some group. In this case, there are people who are Holocaust revisionists who also are very, very anti-Jewish and dislike all Jewish people and talk rudely and crudely about that. And yeah, I actually don't want those people on my show. If they do that stuff, I will yell at them. And I've done that. My first ever radio show was actually yelling at somebody like that.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. Reasonable discussion of these topics, how can that be considered bad? If whatever you think about it, reasonable discussion will only get us closer to the truth and mutual understanding and away from violence. So that's good.
Yeah, I remember when I was based in Spain, I interviewed Ephraim Zuroff a couple of times. And, you know, he wouldn't dare or dream. I shouldn't say dare, but he wouldn't come anywhere near me now because he would label me as anti-Semitic or as somebody who, you know, dislikes Jews, which is complete nonsense, of course. But I used to speak to guys like him, and the Anti-Defamation League people used to come on the program, and I would argue with them. One of the things I said to Zuroff about Holocaust denial after, you know, he grilled me about what I thought, and I told him the truth. I said, you know, Jews were murdered in great numbers. I said 6 million, who knows, it's an awful lot of people. I don't know if they could have done that, but anyway, that's your estimate. I'm not sure about that. But also a lot of other people were murdered. 4 million Vietnamese were murdered in that period of that conflict in Vietnam. He said we could be here all day long. But I did say to Zuroff at the time quite clearly, and I wish I had a recording of the interview, I said to him, I wish that rather than demand that people are arrested, that your scholars would debate these people publicly and debunk them and dismiss their theories rather than demand that they be locked up, because I'll never agree with anybody being locked up for what they think, even if I vehemently disagree with it. And I've said to Jewish people before, whom I know personally, how could some guy say it never happened? How could that offend you? Don't be ridiculous. You know that Jews were imprisoned and murdered in World War II. If some guy is flat out saying it didn't happen, well, he's a moron. If some other guy is saying, well, I don't know about the numbers, well, either engage him in a debate about that or just ignore him. And I've always been like that, Kevin, my entire career. And that's the way I'll always be.
Makes sense to me. And I think it's also interesting, as you suggested, to look at Holocaust and genocides in context. That is, look at the whole history of them. And it's a pretty horrible history. And the 20th century was the worst century for this kind of thing. I've had Gideon Paglia on my show. You should have him on sometime, Richie, if you haven't. He's great. He's a scientist from Australia who has done a lot of comparative Holocaust and genocide research. And he doesn't really question the official story of the Nazi Holocaust. But what he does do is look really carefully at all of these others, the Bengal Holocaust of 4+ million people that the British perpetrated during a couple of years of World War II, the Irish so-called potato famine, which was a deliberate Holocaust. The British troops stole all the food from Ireland and made people starve.
That's right.
They just let them starve.
That's right.
And on and on and on. And we, you know, like we could go on all day. And so, yeah, bring on Gideon Paglia, who's Jewish, by the way, another of my radio guests who are Jewish that the Zionists don't like. Jews are disproportionately represented among the people striving for truth and justice, just as they're disproportionately represented among the wealthy and selfish people. I don't know why that is, but you know, we shouldn't be thinking only one way about Jews or any other group. You know, individuals are individuals.
Right. And Holocaust and genocide is Holocaust and genocide, no matter who it's perpetrated against. I did speak to a German Jewish gentleman years ago in Spain, and he was an avid listener to my evening program, which is where I first met your good self, Kev. And he came on to me one night. He wouldn't come on the air, but he came on to me when I had a music track playing. He came on, he was talking to me, and he said, look, he said, my people, and I used to argue with him jokingly, because I used to say, look, there are no people, you're not a race, no more than Christians are a race or Muslims are a race. And he agreed with that. He said, well, we're not a race, it's an identity. And he agreed with that. But he said, look, we were murdered, and we were murdered in enormous numbers in Germany and in Poland, Richie. He said, I do believe that. But he said, I'll tell you what's always troubled me. And I said, what? What's always troubled you? And he said, all these ridiculous stories about lampshades being made out of skin and babies being stomped to death by burly guards wearing jackboots, these stories that were debunked. He said, that's what Norman Finkelstein was talking about in the exploitation of the Holocaust. That's terrible, he said. And that leaves you very uncomfortable thinking about, why lie? It was bad enough anyway what was done. Why lie and invent all these stories? And I always thought, yeah, that's a good question. Why invent these horror stories? I'll give you the final word on that, Kevin, and we'll then leave it for today. It's been terrific having you back on this week. I really appreciate it. Final word on that then before we wrap it up today.
Well, horror stories are great propaganda. I know Nick Kollerstrom, who was kicked out of University College London for writing a chemistry and history analysis, argues that British intelligence actually laid the basis for the later exaggerated version of the Nazi Holocaust. So that's another long subject that I'm not the person to do justice to. But yes, we always get the big, powerful story about the atrocities. These are the stories that serve the interests of somebody who's got power. And then when the powerless are brutally oppressed and murdered in much greater numbers, we're likely to never hear about it. So we need to consciously adjust our perceptions for that and look for truth rather than just accepting the propaganda stories of the powerful.
Yeah, and I believe, Kevin, I will give you the final word. We have a couple of minutes. I believe that in parts of the world, over the centuries, Jews or people of Jewish faith, historically, I believe, in places around the world, have not been welcome and have been targeted. And there was an interesting program on BBC Radio 4 about this the other day, and it wasn't a typical propaganda program about, oh, feel sorry for the Jews. It wasn't. It was very interesting about, you know, the conspiracy theories about Jews in certain parts of the world over the years. Jews have been targeted. There's no doubt about that. They were targeted in Germany. They were murdered. They were rounded up. I have no doubt about that. But I always go back to Norman Finkelstein. It's the exploitation of it. It was used then, the terrible things that happened, as the pretext for, well, we're the eternal victim and we can do no wrong. So we can invade countries. We can annex the Golan Heights. We can murder people in Gaza indiscriminately and nobody can say anything. And that's what I've got a big problem with. And I think that's why you get so much of this nonsense about anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. It's because most people are sensible and they are right thinking. They understand the Jews were targeted, the Jews were murdered, they understand what happened in the Holocaust. But what everything that's happened since then has been the Jews behaving like the Nazis and then some, and saying, well, you can't criticise us, you can't speak about us because of all the things that happened to us over the years. And that's why I love the Holocaust industry. For me, a very important book as well. Absolutely final word to you, Kevin. We'll wrap it up then.
Okay, I agree with everything you just said, Richie. And yeah, Jews have been disproportionately scapegoated and persecuted in Western societies. There's another side to it, too, though. Various factors led to that scapegoating and persecution that should also be discussed. And Laurent Guyonneau's book, From Yahweh to Zion, does a terrific job. He's a French historian. Once again, the name is Guyonneau, From Yahweh to Zion. That one's highly recommended. So again, I appreciate your being willing to honestly discuss all these issues. Instead of censoring you, they should be giving you a medal, Richie, because you're actually helping people think about these things critically, let off steam, get closer to the truth. And in the end, that's what promotes the positive outcomes. And I think all of this censorship is just fueling the kind of extreme racist hysteria on all sides that could lead to a lot of negative outcomes.
Yeah, it's a good way to finish, Kev. Well said. Listen, thanks for coming back on truthjihad.com. I know a lot of our listeners, they knew about you long before they ever heard of me. They've been listening to your programs and the old shows you did with Jim and everything else. Truthjihad.com. Top man, Kev. All the best to Rabia, by the way. And I hope next month or in 6 weeks' time or thereabouts we'll do it again. Cheers, mate.
Okay, thanks, Richie. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Kevin. Kevin Barrett, live from Wisconsin today on your Richie Allen Show. TruthJihad.com is where you'll find out more about Kevin in the unlikely event you've not come across him before. And he's given a couple of guest recommendations there, as Kevin. We must get on to these people. Good of him to do that and invite them on the programme. Thanks so much to Kevin. Thanks for listening to my long-winded preamble in the first hour about the Jeremy Vine Show and vaccines today. As bad as I was, and I was a bit ranty, it is important that we analyse that sort of thing. That's the sort of thing that the European Union wants to prevent us doing, by the way, with the copyright directive. They want to stop us using that audio to debunk and to basically tear apart that narrative and those claims. And that's very important. And maybe we'll get into that with my friend Hayden Hewitt, with his permission, in the next day or so on the Richie Allen Show. You look after yourselves and one another. Hi to Phil Restino, who's been texting me. How you doing, Phil, in Florida? Bye now. Speak tomorrow.